attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try and I
Hello.
Try.
This won't be the voice you're expecting. The voice one call to action pest, sorry, guest, Andrew Bolton, said sounds like a cartoon toilet brush. Giles, this pod's usual host, has managed to come down with some mangy combination of tonsillitis and pneumonia, and he's lost his voice. So, he's tapped me in for a one-week cameo. I'm Beth. I produce and manage the show behind the scenes. I pretty much do everything Giles doesn't, which is a lot. It's been 5 years since Call to Action captured the first of what's now over 130 heroes and allies from the industry frontline to have a chinwag with. The show is still very much like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite.
I've always wanted to say that.
And to celebrate, we're re-releasing a choice cut of our all-time favourite episodes. In September 2020, we pulled a network agency worm out of the Big Apple and used it as bait to catch one of advertising's biggest fish, the one and only George Tannenbaum. George doesn't need any introduction, but I've started now. One of the most highly awarded, revered, and talented copywriters and creative directors on the planet, George was executive creative director and copy chief at Ogilvy for over 10 years. Initially released as a two-parter, we've sewn the chat back together for this, the director's cut. So strap in for an hour and 20 minutes of George's blissful yet biting New York tones. And watch out for an unmissable cameo from the sensationally satirical swine, Le Agency Holding Company CEO. Feel better about marketing with Call to Action and George Tannenbaum. And Giles, feel better, please. I really don't want to do this again.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, advertising and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today, I've caught George Tannenbaum. George says, "Today, despite all the concocted and virulent bullshit about diversity, as a society, we do not like people who are not like us. If they could toss people aged 50 plus out, most agencies would happily build that wall." Welcome to the show, George. But firstly, welcome to the show, Le Agency Holding Company's CEO, who has his top tips on running a successful network agency in 2020.
Hello again, Giles. It is I, Le Agency Holding Company CEO, and I am so happy to be here, especially since in your wonderful introduction, you have used one of my favorite words, a word I have used as a shibboleth to my entire career. I have used as a signpost, a guidepost, a beacon to guide me through my path to success, to the 1% of the 1%, to making money like no one else makes money. And that word, my friend, is bollocks. Bollocks. Bollocks in today's world, bollocks matters. It is all about bollocks. The more bollocks you are, the more quality you are, the more bullshit, the more honest, the more big, the more small, the more in, the more out, the more up, the more down. That is bollocks, my friends, and that is what matters. You attract customers by keeping them away. You get clients by treating them badly. That is the bollocks way, and that is what we at the holding company hold. That's why they call us the holding company. That is what we do. We are bollocks. You understand? Bollocks, yes?
May we.
Okay, listen. I am done with the provinces now. I have to go back to the mother country. I am back in my, I'm taking my private jet to my private helicopter. I'm going back to Paris. I leave you all in the provinces. Goodbye, London. You have bad food, but beautiful people. Thank you. This is the holding company CEO saying farewell. Au revoir. Goodbye. Charles Lindbergh. Goodbye.
Salut. Oh, so that must just be only you left, George.
Yeah, you know, I never know when he's going to show up. he's a lovely guy. I love him.
Good. Oh, misunderstood. Oh, brilliant. Right, let's get into it. Quick fire questions. We've got seven, George. We've got sure. Tea or coffee?
Oh, coffee, by far.
Apple or IBM?
That's kind of a story. You know, like most creatives, I was always an Apple man. When IBM sold PCs, I had this crazy idea of actually using my client's product. And I switched to an Apple ThinkPad. An IBM ThinkPad. At the time, IBM was still making computers. They sold that division. And I loved the ThinkPad. The ThinkPad was fantastic. If you're using a PC in the world, even when I was doing it, say 15 years ago, if you're using a PC in the world as a creative, it's a little bit like walking around black and white in a color world. You have to go Mac.
Yeah, yeah, true. Good answer. Independent or network?
Oh, independent.
French fries or French toast?
Oh, that's a salt and sweet question, because that's mood contingent, because sometimes I need salt, sometimes I want sweet.
Well, that's a Rob Schwartz one, so he needs an answer.
Oh, I'd go French toast, just in honor of the holding company CEO.
Good stuff, yeah. Okay, three more. Yankees or Mets?
Oh, God, that's hard. I'm going Mets. You know, I'm a Yankee hater. I'll tell you the backstory there. The Yankees were owned for many years by an archetype of what's become Donald Trump, a bully who inherited millions from his father and pretended he made it by himself. And he would boss people around, fire people willy-nilly. A guy called George Steinbrenner. And it was actually convicted and sent and commuted by Richard Nixon. But Yankees are bullies, and I more than any other archetype, I hate bullies. And it's kind of an American, I'm not saying it's not an English thing, because I read Tom Brown's School Days, but it's, you know, this American, like, I did it all by myself, except for the $172 million I inherited from my father, bully. Yeah. And that's what Steinbrenner was, and that's what our current and president is. And I hate that type. I can't root for the Yankees because of that.
Yeah,
I have fond Yankee memories because I grew up when the Yankees were, you know, pre all this. But I can't root for the Yankees. The Mets are hapless and I find them unlikable. But I'd prefer almost anyone to a bully. Like, I'd prefer Mussolini to Hitler.
That's my next quickfire. Well, there is a bully link here, I think. So you've got two left. Famous Chucks, Gary Vaynerchuk or Chuck Norris?
Oh, God. That's a very similar question. I guess I don't really know anything about Chuck Norris, except I think he's a far-right supporter. So I'm going to go Vaynerchuk, even though I can't stand the guy.
Okay, and last one's tricky. Ron Rosenfeld or Len Sirowitz?
Oh, my. In my humble belief, and I worked for them, Len had more talent. Ron won more awards, but by the time I got to know them, Ron was tuned out. He was more of a general contractor in different homes in Sag Harbor. And Len, you could get excited about work still. Ron was no longer excited about work. So I preferred Len. He never showed me his ill temper. I heard from peers that he had a really bad temper and was very mean. He never showed it to me. I'll tell you, though, with Ron, may I be discursive?
Please.
So the agency, Rosenfeld, Sirowitz, whatever it was, Humphrey and Strauss, occupied a floor of a building at 111 Fifth Avenue on Fifth Avenue and 18th Street. And the building itself was two or three cast iron buildings from the turn of last century that were
amalgamated together. So the building, the footprint went from 18th Street to 19th Street, from 5th Avenue to Broadway. Broadway down there is diagonal, so it's not quite a square block because it's diagonal, so the floor was a little longer. But I sat on the Broadway and 19th side. Ron and Len literally sat on a pedestal on the 18th and 5th Avenue side. So it was a full block from to get to my office from their office. So when I had copy to show to Ron, Ron was a Hall of Fame copywriter, and I didn't have a great deal of respect for him pretty early on, but I still had to show him copy. I would call his secretary. We still had phones in those days, not cell phones. And I would say, I forget what her name was, Donna, tell me when Ron's getting ready to go to lunch. Because I knew if he was hungry, he was a man of appetite. I knew if he was hungry, he wouldn't linger. And so she would call me when he was, you know, getting his parcels together to go to lunch. And I would leave my office when I got the call. I would time it just so I got to the elevator, when he got to the elevator. Because I could walk a block in the time he could walk 40 feet. So we would meet at the elevator. It was all, you know, quote unquote, serendipitous. And I'd say, oh, Ron, I got to show you a copy. And he'd look at his watch. He'd be annoyed with me. I got to go. I'm going out to lunch. I said, oh, just take a minute. It's just a short piece of copy. And that's how I would show him copy before the elevator came. And that's how I dealt with Ron. Because if I gave him half an hour, I would have been there all night. But if I gave him 30 seconds, that's how I got through. That probably wasn't fair, but I did it.
Yeah. No, that's a good story. It makes sense as well. Now, George, we always like to ask how people's lives and careers start off, particularly because I always enjoy the scenic route that many seem to take coming into the industry. So can you tell us how it all began for you? But please make sure you elaborate on your season in the Mexican Baseball League under a certain Hector Quesadilla.
Well, Hector, oh, thank you. Well, my story goes back to 19. I'm born in 1957. My story goes back to 1945 because my father's family, he was one of three boys of immigrant mongrel Russian Jews, who got pogromed out of Russia. They arrived in Philadelphia with no money and no English. And quickly became the boys, not the parent. The father died. My grandmother lived on, but she never learned to speak English. The boys quickly became a kind of breed of first-generation Jew, like a little fast-talking, hard-working, always looking for an angle, making it. If you know the character, Bud Schulberg wrote the book, What Makes Sammy Run, about a guy who's a little too aggressive, works a little too hard, his shoes are maybe a little too polished, and he's going to make it to the top no matter what. And my father's brother, Sidney, was one of those guys. He opened up an ad agency in Philadelphia called Waitman Advertising. It was called Waitman Advertising because they rented rooms in a building called the Waitman Building on Chestnut Street, and he wanted his clients to think he owned the building. So he named his agency after the building. And so he opened that around 1945. When my father left college, he did a little work for Waitman Advertising to get for his brother, and he learned the ropes. Now, these were the early days of television, because say it was 1949, 1950, probably 80,000 sets in the United States at the time. So television was like digital was in 1996. You know, a lot of it was, if you were doing something for a refrigerator company, you were selling refrigerators to housewives. And I know that's gendered, but that was the world back then. It was like, look how simply the door opens. See how the shelves pull out. It was really demonstrations and really, you can understand that, though. It's very much like kind of, I guess today we call it content or long form. This is how it works. And that's where my father cut his teeth. He then got to, he went across the river in an industrial city called Camden, which is probably one of the poorest cities in the United States now, but it was the headquarters of RCA, and worked in the advertising department there. RCA in the late 40s, early 50s was like Apple Computer is today or Tesla. And my father got experience there as a copywriter. And then in 1954, he and my mother moved to New York. They got married in 53, moved to New York, and he got a job at a bland but top 15 agency called Kenyon Eckhart, which merged into Bozell, which merged into Amirati, which merged into SSCMB, which is now out of business. The holding companies did that. And he did very well there. So he moved up from copywriter or junior copywriter to chairman of the board in probably 15 years. At a time when you can be CEO and a creative and in your early 40s. But the world I grew up in was, he was never home. And by the time he was early 40, he had had two heart attacks.
Wow.
So, which was kind of, so people would say to me, George, do you watch Mad Men? And I said, no, I think it would be too painful for me to tell you the truth. So I've never watched an episode. Mm-hmm. So I spent my childhood saying, God, I don't ever want to do this. So I wanted to be an academic. I wanted to live in a little leafy college town and read and write and do that. After baseball was over, I went to school in New York and I got my degree and I got a master's degree. But I quickly found out I really didn't have and it's actually hindering me. It actually hindered me in the business. I really didn't, in the advertising business, I really don't have patience for bullshit. And as you know, a lot of academia is bullshit because we've solved all the big questions. What does the whale mean? Now, yeah. You know, in Moby Dick. Now we have to get into like the esoteric stuff, like weather conditions in Shakespeare's Macbeth. And their forecast of global warming or the Little Ice Age's influence on King Lear. Oh, my God.
They got to zoom in so far, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, because, you know, you have to do something original.
Yeah.
And, you know, Shakespeare, for example, you're 400 years in. So, you know, you can't talk about order being upset. You know, people were writing that essay in the 1700s. So you have to find, you know, something about, you know, newts and the portrayal of witchcraft in medieval literature. Okay. You know, I didn't have patience for it, to be honest with you, because most people don't get the basics. And I was more interested in kind of helping people get the basics. Anyway, academia, I quickly found, wasn't for me. 22... living in a really dangerous New York. And the last thing I want to do is go to my parents' home and live there and look for a job and go to law school as they wanted me to do. So because talk about theoretical and esoteric, I really didn't want to do that. I got a job, so to speak, advertising job. I answered a help wanted ad in the New York Times at the time, probably had a 30-page help wanted ad section. And each ad, New York Times, a broadsheet for people in the UK who don't know, it's not a tabloid. So each ad was probably 3/8 of an inch by a column width, so an inch and a half. And it was 30 pages of ads. And I looked at copywriters. I got an ad for a catalog company called Montgomery Ward, which was probably like the poor man's Sears. And I ran down to the garment district where their offices were. It's a big company. And I took a test, a copy test, and I passed it. And I think I went to work the next day. Okay, this is fine. This is something kind of I understood. And I took a class at School of Visual Arts. And I moved from that catalog copy after a couple of years to the in-house advertising department of a store in New York called Bloomingdale's. And I worked there for a couple of years and I refined my book. You know, at the time, New York had dozens of agencies, not like today. There were many, many more agencies. And, pretty much every lunch hour, it was still physical books at the time. And so you couldn't just email a book. And you'd run down to, you know, 6th Avenue and 44th Street and drop your portfolio. And then you'd run to another place, Lexington and 45th, and drop your portfolio. And then, you know, that would be your lunch hour. And I eventually got a job at an agency called Loeb Marshall. And, you know, and then from there, you just kind of keep going and or keep getting deeper down the rabbit hole. And, you know, and then you're making too much money to get out, and then children and whatever. But, you know, I truly enjoy the business enjoyed the business. I'm going to put that in past tense, and never had a heart attack. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I tried to do a better job kind of balancing my work and my life than my old man did. You know, I never really got along with him or my mother. And I used to say, you know, no one's totally useless. They can always serve as a bad example. And that's kind of how I saw his career. So I had his overarching ambition to do well, but I tried to kind of leave at night.
Yeah, I think that's important. I don't think enough people do try and leave at night, sadly. It's a bizarre hustle porn badge of honor in many, many shops.
Yeah, a hustle porn brings us back to one of your flash questions with Gary Vaynerchuk, and maybe I'll change it to Chuck Norris.
Yeah. Yeah, why choose? Why choose? I was going to talk to you more about Ron and Len. So you essentially learned copywriting from those two kind of Hall of Famers.
Well, yes and no. I went there because at the time there were, I'd say, three stratas of agencies in New York. There were the giant agencies, the McCanns and BBDOs, the Ogilvies. There were the small agencies around 150 people, and then there were the in-between, like 300 people agencies. And at the time, the best agencies were in that middle tier. They were around 400 people, which meant they were big enough to handle national accounts and have big budgets. But they weren't so big like the McCanns and the BBDOs that you'd have 7 teams on an assignment, and you might never see anyone above an ACD. At the time, ACD meant something. Then, and you never really wanted to go too small, because you might just be working on like a carpet shop, a local carpet shop, and it wouldn't be, if it was a magazine ad or a newspaper ad, it wouldn't be full page because they didn't have the money. You probably wouldn't be doing broadcast, blah, blah, blah. Ron and Len were slightly different because they were both Hall of Famers. I had come from a mid-sized shop, Marshawk, which was a good agency, but didn't have a great reputation. I wasn't getting great assignments. I wanted more. I didn't like my ACG at the time. I didn't think she was very good. And I wanted more. I had an end game. I wanted to go to a place called Amirati or Scali. Those were the two best shops at the time in New York. And I thought that working for two Hall of Famers, I would hone my craft, that I would get to know my craft, not even hone it. And then I found out Ron and Lennon were pretty much tuned out. But, and here's the big but, I was 6 blocks away from maybe the largest used bookstore in the world, certainly the largest one in New York, called The Strand. And on 12th and Broadway, we were on 18th and Broadway. And I quickly found out you could buy used awards annuals for $10. So every lunch hour, I would, twice a week maybe, I would run down to the Strand and buy another awards annual that I didn't have. I didn't have a ton of money in those days. So to spend $25 on books was basically my dinner money. But that's what I did with my dinner money. And by the end of my 20 months at Roosevelt, I had probably 100 awards annuals, probably going back from 1962. This is 1990, I left there. I probably had every art directors and one show. DNAD hadn't really made it to America yet. But I probably had every art directors and one show annual between those years. I had literally dozens of them. Coming as I did, in a sense, from an academic background, I was academic in how I approached them. I don't take notes because I have a really good memory, but I would identify people whose work I liked And just like if I liked Faulkner, I would go deep and read everything that Faulkner wrote. And then I would find an interstitial off of Faulkner and go to Catherine Ann Porter or go to this one or go to that one and find out. And I would do the same thing with creative people. I would find people I liked. I would literally study their copy. And that's where I learned really much less from Ron and Lan and much more from these annuals. One evening, Len came to my office because he liked to hang out with me. And he gave me this book. And he had done hundreds and hundreds of ads for an institute to help prevent childhood blindness. And he had done some amazing, amazing ads. And he gave me a bound book of literally 100 of these ads. And they were wonderful. I don't know who the writers were, because if you ask Len, he did everything. But but he had an ego, but he wasn't nefarious about it. He wasn't evil about it. But you know, these were fantastic. They're still fantastic today. They just happen to be black and white, you know, and a very simple kind of, you know, photograph on the top, headline, and three columns of copy, that kind of thing. But yeah. No one's improved on that, by the way. So it was more a education of osmosis than an education of pedantry, if I can use big words. Yeah, it was more like I was around these people. I was in a milieu. I studied. I knew who I wanted to emulate. I learned who I wanted to emulate, and I emulated them. And I knew where I wanted to go.
Yeah, you just said that nobody's improved on that, by the way, and I'm in agreement with you there. Would you say, in a nutshell, it's because many have become too focused on the delivery mechanism and not what's being delivered?
You know, my last campaign, I was at Ogilvy two times. And my last campaign, when I left the first time, was for some technology product at IBM. And, you know, technology products are boring in many ways. And, you know, basically, I wrote good headlines. We took a picture of the products. I wrote some copy. I put some specs in them because it was that kind of a product. And so I guess we were entering it for award shows, whatever. And the account person says to me, well, what are we calling this campaign? And I'm looking at her and I don't have a big concept here. It was just write headlines and have a picture, say what the product does and have a picture of the product. So I said, I don't know, call it the Big Type campaign. Because my thesis was really simple. We were in the newspaper at the time, the New York Times and the Journal. People still read newspapers. And I said, maybe this is too stupid and too simple, but I want to have the biggest type in the newspaper. Yeah. I mean, if everyone else has 16-point type, I want to have 36-point type. Because which one's going to get seen? Yeah. I mean, if you have two stop signs, which one's going to get seen? My job is to get seen. And you know, I love Dave Trott, you know, who breaks down communication into, you know, attention, communication, persuasion. Well, in terms of attention and hierarchy, what is better than that paradigm I mentioned before, or having the biggest type in the magazine? It's the same thing car dealers do, you know, on local television. They mix their commercials louder.
Yeah, and you know the whole attention or impact, communication, persuasion, they're almost three consecutive hurdles, and if you don't vault that first one, then the other two are totally irrelevant anyway.
Exactly. It's I mean, even, you know, they ignore the Ogilvyisms now, but at Ogilvy, but you know, 95 times more people are going to read the headline than the body copy.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, if you don't get people to read your headline, why are we struggling over body cut?
Exactly, yeah. Same point, well put as well. Just quickly on Ron and Len, I've read that they both wanted you to marry their daughters. So assuming they both liked their daughters, that's quite a compliment.
You know, there's a New York Jewish thing going on here too.
Okay.
You know, like I'm a New York Jew, I'm a hustler, I work hard, I'm a good boy, no drugs, no tattoos, no yeah. Anything. So it's like, yeah, okay, I'm not a doctor, but I'm also not, you know, I'm not running to the racetrack. I'm not, you know, I'm not doing lots of naughty things. So yeah, I'm the advertising equivalent of a CPA. I'm as stable as it gets for being out of my mind.
Yeah, that's so Rory Sutherland talks about satisficing, doesn't he? So he says consumers aren't maximizing. They're not trying to maximize their utility when they spend. They're just trying to reduce the risks. So they shop, they satisfy. So maybe, so you're the perfect satisficing son-in-law.
Yeah. There you go. You know, my wife, we've been married 36 years. She's short. She's 5'1". I'm 6'2". And, you know, in my darker moments, I'll say, basically, we've been married for 36 years. I can get things off of top shelves. It's not, it's not the worst thing to happen. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, there you go. There's your features and benefits. George, 6'1", benefit, get stuff off shelves.
Love yeah. It. Yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know what? There's a lot to be said by stuff like that. There's a lot to be said. Like, yes, you know, she can carry buckets of water in from the well. I'll marry her. I mean, that's the way the
word would like to meet. That's awesome.
It's going to get me a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, well, she's getting the first cut. So can we talk about, we don't have to go too deep on it either, but can we talk about ageism in industry? Because in the industry, I don't feel like it's, I mean, it is topical to talk about now and it's relevant and appropriate and all of those things wrongly. And I don't think it's new.
No.
I just think maybe there's a few more lights shining on it at the moment.
I really think, and I've been saying this for a while, I mean, the thing that Mark Reed said last week, you know, whatever, 80% is under 30 and nobody has, nobody harks back to the 80s, luckily. I mean, that was just asinine. Mm. I'll tell you, I was more upset by something this guy called Abby Don wrote in Forbes afterwards. And because really ageism in an advertising agency now is I don't want to payism. And the business as it's constructed is meant to enrich the owners of the business. It's not meant to help clients anymore. I know this is super cynical, but you know, if you look at the C-level of the holding companies, they're all making 7 or 8 figure salaries. You know, your friend Marty Sorrell, you know, made hundreds of millions of dollars for many, many years. You can't take that much out of an industry and expect the industry to do well. So, right. I mean, the money just isn't there. So, I mean, it's a little bit, and I run a little red, but it's a little bit the same thing the East India Company did to India. We're going to take all the wealth out and leave nothing back, nothing behind. So that's kind of what the holding companies have done. And people of my vintage were used to the industry where you could make good money, you could live in a nice house, you could have cars and retirements and things like that. And they don't want to do that. They don't want to pay those salaries anymore because they might impinge upon the $16 million that the C-level gets. So what the industry's become, and the parallels to the what used to be the news industry are pretty great. The venture or vulture capitalists, depending on how you look at it, have come in and said, well, there's a lot of revenue that flows through this place. I'm going to take 87% of the revenue, run the place on the 13% I leave behind, and then clients or readers in the news industry, clients in the ad industry say, well, I'm not getting any value, but I need an ad agency, so I'll just cut my fees.
Mm.
So the vulture capitalists say, okay, well, we have to take more out of this to keep our profit margins high. And the service gets lower and lower. You've seen this.
Yeah.
The service gets lower and lower. The skill level gets less and less. The value add gets less and less. And the business is driving itself into extinction. I don't know what value it provides. And so... yeah, there's ageism because nobody wants to see, you know, old fat men around. We're the last group you're really allowed to make fun of publicly without worry. But they really don't want to pay people who are making decent salaries, middle class, upper middle class salaries, let's say. I mean, they'd much rather pay someone, you know, a quarter or a third or a fourth or a fifth of what I make. It's a lot easier to run a business that way.
Yeah. And it's and the only direction is down, isn't it?
I know enough about the business. You know, let me put it to you this way. You know, Martin Sorrell, and you were probably, being English, you would know this better than I. For a number of years, he made, I believe, $100 million a year. So the way my math says, my math goes, is WPP, if they paid him $10 million a year, it's still a lot of money, I think. They could have employed 900 creative people making $100,000 each with the money they saved.
Yeah.
Now, which one would have left WPP in better shape? I mean, you can argue either way. That's fine with me. But I happen to think investing in the company and assuming that a third of those 900,000 people would have done something positive for a client, I happen to think that the business would be in better shape if you reinvested in the business. The same way an automotive company, and, you know, would have been better if they kept reinvesting in their plant, in making more efficient cars, or engines, or R&D, or this, or that. But no, instead, you know, the upper 1%, whatever it was, said, well, we're taking money out. We're taking money out, and we all have country places.
Yeah. There's a great, he's a CFO, but I know his experience. He's worn many hats in his career, I believe. A guy called Alistair Thompson. And he's one of the smartest finance guys I know, certainly that I've ever met. And he made a point to me a few weeks ago talking about a different but, you know, indirectly fairly similar point. And he said the trouble is with the cost-cutting approach is you can only cut what's already there. But with creativity, you can grow infinitely.
Exactly. And creativity demands an investment. You know, and that's what, you know, I spent the first 20 years in the business, or 10 out of 40, let's say. I didn't have to do timesheets. My job was to understand everything I could about this client. And nobody said you have to work 24 hours a day. But if I was working on a bank, part of my job, as I saw it, was to wake up in the morning and read the Wall Street Journal, because that's what my customers were reading. And that's what my clients were reading. And how can I talk to... And so I couldn't put that on a timesheet, because how do you put that on a timesheet?
Yeah.
But you're supposed to live and breathe your clients. Now it's like, no, you have 2 hours to do this. Write an ad about oil burners. You have 2 hours. Well, I don't know anything about an oil burner. I live in an apartment. Well, here's a 68-page deck. Okay. That's the way the business works now. As opposed to when I was a kid, I would have gone out with plumbers. And, you know, I would have talked to people in the winter when it's cold about what it feels like. You know, you would have done that.
Yeah.
There would have been some humanity and empathy, I think. I think that's gone now. That doesn't fit on a timesheet.
Yeah. And I think even retrospectively in Mark Reed's case, but I suppose regardless, he had to come out and say it was quoted out of context, because otherwise he would have been in the firing line even more. But they all typically claim they value experience and, you know, age and diversity, but the stats are wrong. Now you've got the stats.
I said, I don't care if it's out of context or not. I can say to you, Giles, I hate left-handers. I would never hire someone who's left-handed. And then it makes the trade press. Tannenbaum hates left-handers. Yeah. And I said, you know what? I'm sorry, guys. I was quoted out of context. I actually love left-handers. And then if you show me a chart that says my company, out of 100 people I employ, only one is left-handed, I don't give a shit what the context is. I really don't give a shit. I mean, I wrote that poem. I don't know if you saw the poem I wrote.
I did. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I didn't say the things I said. I didn't mean the things I meant. I mean, I don't care what you said. 2% of your people are over 60. You can't tell me you value them. 25% of the population, 45% of the wealth, you'd never get away with that in any other quote-unquote protected group. You'd be hanging from a lamppost on Madison Avenue.
Yeah, totally, totally. Just as an aside, over 50% of my little agency are left-handed, which is fucking weird. It's weird. My wife's left-handed. I'm constantly reminding her that Hitler was too.
Time, weather, and...
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod-listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on measuring their brand health. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
There aren't very many good things about getting older.
Oops. Well, there's only one Bob Hoffman. Episode 24 of Call to Action was a classic, but hold on.
Let's quickly talk about copywriting. I don't want to do you a disservice because, Christ, we could talk all day and should talk all day to you about copywriting, but are there parallels with what we've just talked about with ageism and generally, if we can be so broad as to say the bullshit in the industry, has that crept into what we do as, you know, the real creativity in copywriting?
Well, you know, I quote a lot in the blog. There's an American writer. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, and I've seen him speak maybe 10 times. His name is Robert Caro. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, 2 National Book Awards, and he's written the book about the making of New York City called The Power Broker, and then a 4-volume, probably 3,000 pages on President Lyndon Johnson. He's working on the 5th volume. It's a race between him and the great timekeeper, because he's 85. He tells a story when he was at Princeton University. He was in a writing class. He had a courtly old Southern gentleman who was the professor, who was a noted writer at the time. And Caro would always, you know, they get 2 weeks to write something, and Caro would always wait till the night before. And he was always able to write fast the way he tells it. And he would sit down and he would type a story. And he'd always get A's because he's an excellent writer, A being the highest mark. And he tells the story how in his last session, the teacher calls him in. I forget the man's name. And he says something, and this might be an exact quote. I'm going to do it as close as I can. He said, "Mr. Caro, I don't know what your goals are. I don't know what you intend to do with your life." You know, he's 21 at the time, let's say. "But you will never achieve what you want to achieve if you continue to think with your fingers." And, you know, if you think about, and he narrows, I've taken a lot of what he's written and narrowed it down into some kind of functional rules, or not rules, behaviors for myself. And one of them is time equals truth. It takes time to get to the truth. And again, if I were to do, this is a terrible example, it's because I'm sitting in my basement, but so the only thing in front of me is this obsolete oil burner we have down here. We just bought an old house in Connecticut. I don't know anything about oil burners. So if I have to write an ad for this oil burner and it's due in 2 hours, I have no time to make truth. I'm just going to say, "Stay cozy, warm all winter long. The coldest day, you'll feel warm." And you know what? That might suck. That might not suck. But it's going to be like, if there's 100 lines about oil burners, 97 of them are going to be just like that. 99 of them are going to be just like that. Because I don't really know anything about oil burners. I don't know what's important. I don't know what happens when they go bad. I don't know anything. So I haven't taken the time to find the truth. And that's what we produce today. I'm not blaming the writers. I'm blaming the function. I'm blaming the system. I'm blaming, you know, Malcolm Gladwell would say you need 10,000 hours. You know, I could tell you, going back to baseball, you need to play 1,000 games before you get good. And I need to learn this oil burner. I need to learn how long they last, how thick the steel is. How, you know, what kind of floor they work best, you know, you have to put it on. I need to understand shit. That's, the planners don't know that. You know, Wikipedia doesn't know it. You only know it by talking to old oil burner installers and people who live in a house for 97 years and their grandparents lived in it before them, and, you know, Old Reliable here kept going in the winter of 02. We're not set up to do that anymore.
No, and that's why you believe in factory tours.
Yeah, and you know, on top of it, I think it gets worse because today no one challenges anyone who says people don't read anymore and people don't have attention spans. And I would hear it at that place I worked, what was it, Ogilvie or something?
Yeah, that's it.
And I would say, you know, you tell me people don't have attention spans, and every morning I hear you coming in and talking to people about the 7 hours of binge watching you did the night before. Is that an attention span? Because it sure seems that way to me. And, you know, I know, for instance, the Times, New York Times, which had zero digital subscribers 10 years ago, has 5 million today. So someone's reading. So you're telling me things because you hear them as wisdom or I forget the word, but you haven't given me any proof. And so we're about to have hopefully an election in this country. And, you know, if I were Joe Biden, I would run a 4-page, an 8-page, a 16-page ad of 20,000 words saying exactly what I'm going to do on every issue, and I'd publish it in every major newspaper in the United States. And when Donald Trump says, "You said blah, blah, blah," I say, "No, you know, Donald, actually on page 7, line 42, codicil 9, I said this. And it's there, Donald, in black and white. That's what I'm going to do." I think that has value.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whether or not you read it, there's a visual quality to it that says, if you bought a an $88 bottle of wine, and I decide, if that's your thing, and I decide to put an 8-page thing tied to the wine bottle, and I talk to you about the soil and the farmer and the family and the horses that pull the frickin' plows, I'll sell you that wine. I mean, part of it is you're interested already. I'm not denying that. But I think we need to take time to learn shit, and I don't think anyone's given the time, and they haven't had the training. They haven't been told it's important anymore, because I don't think they teach. I know they don't teach that in ad school.
Yeah, no, they don't. I know that from a couple of grads we've had on our books recently. I've got a couple of listener questions for you, George.
Uh-oh.
So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. But we do have two for you. So Jim asks, he says, your ad-aged blog post on Valentine's Day mentioned that after parting ways with Ogilvie, you've rediscovered your love for advertising. Why do you think that is, and what do you love about it?
Okay, let me see if I can find that so I can, because it's been a little while since Valentine's Day. Well, you know what? I think, you know, when you're at an agency for a long time, you get caught up in the bullshit of the agency rather than the craft of the craft. And I'm not saying craft to be pretentious. I'll tell you, I just finished a really amazing book last night called The Saddest Words. The subtitle is William Faulkner's Civil War. William Faulkner probably isn't too big in the UK.
Yeah.
But once he had some success, he made a little money in Hollywood. He had a couple of novels. You know what? He won the Nobel Prize. What am I talking about? He won the Nobel Prize in 1949. So he said, you know what? Now I can write. I don't have to worry about paying the rent. I don't have to worry about my publishers. Now I can write. And I think when I left Ogilvie, I don't have to rationalize why I want to spend 16 hours learning about oil burners. I can just learn. I can say to the client, I need to learn about your product before I try to write about your product. And you know what? no one's really going to dispute that. Except in an agency, they will, because there's going to be a project manager saying, well, you're only scoped for 4 hours. So, you know, I found this poem, and this might be an answer. I know my answers are never blithe or quick. I'm not good at reading poems, but I'm going to read it. It says, when someone deeply listens to you, it's like holding out a dented cup you've had since childhood and watching it fill up with cold, fresh water. When it balances on top of the brim, you were understood. When it overflows and touches your skin, you were loved. When someone deeply listens to you, the room where you stay starts a new life, and the place where you wrote your first poem begins to glow. It's as if gold has been discovered when someone deeply listens to you. Your bare feet are on the earth, and a beloved land that seemed distant is now at home with you. That, I think, is what we're supposed to do. Yeah. You're supposed to deeply listen. And I think both the client and the viewer, the reader, are going to feel listened to if you listen. And I think that's the reason behind our disdain for advertising today. No one listens.
Perfect. Question two, then, George, is from Sarah. She says, you've been vocal about the deterioration of copywriting, even saying, I think journalists are writing better headlines than copywriters these days. With a rising clickbait and fake news, is this really true?
Well, you know, it depends. It depends on what you're reading. And you know, one of the privileges of blogging is I don't have to fact check anything. I read two newspapers or three. Sometimes I read the Washington Post sometimes, but usually just the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And they're not as clickbaity as like the BuzzFeeds of the world. And when I wrote that line, I had read an article in the Wall Street Journal about Warren Buffett, and it was called Warren Buffett and the $300,000 haircut. And I said to myself, well, that's a damn, how do you not read that? If you're a journal reader anyway, and you basically give a shit about investing in money, that's a pretty good headline. It's startling. And the subhead clarified it. So the hierarchy of the communication was fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to look at the ads I read. And I do most of my reading online, except Sunday, we get the Sunday paper. But I don't recall an ad where I saw a similarly good headline. And idiosyncratic, surprising, silly, quizzical. So, you know, I know there's a lot of clickbaity things. I've written about, you know, 21 ways to make ice cubes. The last one will really blow your mind. You know, it's like, but you know what? That's a betrayal of trust, too. And so I don't, to Sarah, a lot of times, like, because we're all going through our freaking news feeds, and you'll see something like, can you believe this reaction shot from Melania? Or Boris Johnson said what? And you okay, I'll click on it. And then you get to it, and it's like, well, he stepped on a piece of gum, and he looked at his shoe, and can you believe his expression? He goes, just...
Yeah, you've overpromised that.
Yeah, you're a liar. You've lied to me. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a question between, you know, journalism is clickbait and advertising as honest. I think it's respect for the reader. And I think that journalists in at least the two newspapers I read have had to show respect for the consumer's intelligence and time in a way that I'm not 100% sure those words ever come into the calibration of creativity by either creative directors, by creative directors, by account people, by planners, or by clients. Or by clients, by clients, by clients, by clients, by the time it gets up the ladder or down the ladder, whichever way it goes.
Yeah.
So I don't know that respect for the consumer ever enters into the picture. It's all like, what do we want to say? Well, there's a difference.
Yeah, I also think the as long as pay for clicks exists, I mean, clicks are such a blunt metric, but as long as that does exist, then clickbait will exist.
Yeah.
Therein lies a big issue. And equally, Sarah uses the word better, and we can talk about good headlines, but I think it's important also to clarify the difference between a good headline, meaning an effective headline that does the job, and a good headline that you just think is a nice headline.
Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, and I just got done teaching an advertising class at Ad House in New York, you know, over Zoom. When I was a kid in college, you know, there's always a bulletin board, maybe 4 feet by 6 feet. If a kid, you know, a kid lives in Cleveland and is going home to Cleveland, anybody have a ride to Cleveland this week, you know, for Labor Day weekend or something? And I'd say about 5% of the, you know, they were usually handwritten. It was pre-computer. And they'd be, you know, pinned up to the wall. And so if it's, the paper's is A4, 8.5 by 11, whatever, somebody would write, you know, in large 72-point type, the word sex. And then underneath it in small type would say, now that I got your attention, I need a ride to Cleveland. Well, that's clickbait. And that just pisses you off. Because you got, that's gratuitous. That's not respectful. And, you know, respect, honesty are the hallmarks of civilization and communication. And so if you want to do clickbait, that's fine. I'm going to try not to read your magazine because I don't want to be treated like that. The same way I don't want to hear from Verizon or Orange, whatever the telco is, that I can get a month of, you know, unlimited service for $49.95, and then I go into the store and it's $89.95, and I say, what about the commercial? Well, that's if you're left-handed and stand on one leg. You know, you lied to me. Now, those are monopolies. You can't do anything about it. But you're still a liar to me.
Yeah, the trouble is you can't measure that bit, can you? You can't measure getting pissed off with those clickbaits. But what you do get a measure, albeit an ambiguous digital measure, then send signal back to the people who placed the ad that someone clicked on the ad. And I think that therein lies another issue, which
right.
I need to be careful not to start ranting about.
Passion is important.
So the final part of the interview then, George, is our four pertinent poses. So starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
What advice would I give to my younger self? You know, I have two somewhat contrary pieces of advice to my younger self and to my current self, because I don't think people change that much. One, I was brand new at Ogilvy the first time, and I was working for Steve Hayden, who at the time had one of the biggest names in the business. Still does, but he was a legend in his business. He was the writer on Apple's famous 1984 spot. And he was president of Ogilvy on the IBM account. I was brand new. I didn't have a partner. And he, for whatever reason, kind of grabbed me. I was literally there less than a month. He grabbed me. There was an account in trouble. He didn't know me. He interviewed me. He hired me, but he didn't really know me. And he said, this account's in trouble. We need spots. I need you to write spots. And I came in on a weekend, and I probably wrote 60 spots. And I was nervous about, he was an email kind of guy, not a, can I have an hour at 10 o'clock kind of guy. So I was going to email him, and maybe I was avoiding things. I was going to email him spots, and I was paralyzed. And so piece of advice number one is hit the send button. You have to get yourself, I think, to a, and I say this to my own daughters and people in the business, young people in the business I like. You have to get yourself to the point where you believe in your good. Like, it might not be as good as you want it to be. You might not feel like heel clicky about it, but it came from you. It's good. So it's believe that your good is other people's great. and hit the send button. And the little bit of advice that might be contrary to this is know when to close the computer. So know when to say, you know what? I've done my best for the day. I actually do better creatively when I'm taking a shower or walking the dog than I do when I'm staring at my Mac. So I'm going to close the computer. I'm going to go home. I'm going to have a cup of whatever. And that's what I'm going to do. And I'm a big reader. I read a book by a guy called Eric Kandel, The Age of Insight. He's a Nobel Prize neurophysicist from Columbia. And he talks about the power of sleep and creativity, that the generative activity of your brain while you're sleeping if you're a creative person. And I believe that. I believe I've had a good portion of my ideas come together while I'm sleeping, which is why I get into work when I was working at, usually at 6:30 or 7 in the morning. So those are two kind of companion pieces. And then when I went freelancer, when I was forced to go freelance in 2014, I heard two pieces of advice that kind of follow the same pattern in that they're somewhat affirmative but contradictory. One was never say no to a job. And I believe that in an agency too. Never say no. You'll find time. And yeah. Two is know when to press the down button. So take on a lot, but know when to leave at night. And that's a discipline and a trust in yourself that a lot of people don't have, because a lot of people compensate for their own frailty or their own insecurity by saying, well, I'm going to stay till 3 in the morning. Oh, go fuck yourself. I mean, something as simple as I do the Sunday Times crossword puzzle. It's not like your English crossword puzzles. It's not that hard, but it's pretty challenging. And I'm good at it, but there's hardly a time where I don't get better when I walk away for 20 minutes, where I don't look at it and say, I can't get a thing. And then I do the dishes or I walk the dog or, I buy my wife something with diamonds. He's been a straight man to me for 40 years. I come back and all of a sudden the things that were unclear become clear. And, that's obvious, but it takes a long time to figure out.
Yeah. And to allow yourself to do it as well, I think. Yeah. Cool. Number two is, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
You know, I think if I could banish one thing from the industry, I heard this in reference to the epidemic that in America we call the nightly news. It's segments that start with the words, I think. Because you know what? I don't really give a fuck what you think. I don't give a fuck that you think clicks are important. I don't give a fuck that you think the great metric of our age is Facebook likes. I don't... Show me a case where it worked. You know, I was at a vaunted digital shop for 5 years, and I was told that everything from Facebook likes to QR codes to this to that were going to fundamentally change the way human beings breathe, live, act, shit, eat, everything else. And, you know, this one guy, I was working on a brand that literally had 7% aided awareness. And this little, I'll use a Yiddish word, little pisher, sounds like what it is, says to me, what we have to do is get Facebook likes. And I was the odd man out there because I was the one who didn't believe in shit like that. And I said to him, David, all I'm asking for, I'm not saying no. All I'm asking for is one example of one brand it had an impact for. If you can give me one example, I'll agree with you. And he looked at me like I asked him to draw and quarter his grandmother. It's like, how dare you ask for evidence? So, you know, we've lived through the gold, as Bob Hoffman calls it, the golden age of bullshit. You know, and I, the one pushback I'd have on Bob is it's a little bit like it's a golden age. Today is the golden age of bullshit and always has been. I kind of feel like, you know, medieval alchemy will never go away. The concept of alchemy, turning something base metal into gold, will never go away. Today we call it data, or clicks or Facebook likes or something else. But you can't show me the money. You can't show me the gold, straw. You can't turn straw into gold. I know. You know, you can show me the science, but show me it in real life. And then you have to show me again, because anything, you know, if it's a pharmaceutical thing, you can't just do it once. You have to show me again and again and again that you can replicate the conditions that happen and it's not just an anomaly. You know, there's a New Yorker cartoon, two professors or scientists looking at a equation on a board, you know, one of those elaborate like Einsteinian equations, and in the middle of it they have the words, "and then a miracle happened." You know, I think we need some clarification there. You know, I think, yeah, miracles do happen, but it's the replicability that makes it something.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's the modern day bleeding people with leeches. There'll always be something, won't there? But you're right. I mean, anything that starts, I think, I know Dave Trotz talked about this before, and he says that's the language of the consumer, not the professional. It works or it doesn't work. Don't give me subjectivity.
You hear a lot during the day. You hear a lot of received opinions as fact. And, you know, it's a little bit the malady of our age. We hear it in politics. We hear it in personal relationships. We hear it in everything. And I think we have to be a little bit, I'm not saying that we can only believe in facts, but we have to, I think, be a little more cynical. Maybe people my age, I'm 62, have an advantage because I grew up during Vietnam and Richard Nixon. So you questioned everything. We were trained to question everything, kind of as that was a, what I would call a classic liberal New York upbringing. If you heard, because we used to listen, my mother would have the news on at night on the radio, and they would give the casualty figures from Vietnam. And they would say, you know, 800 North Vietnamese deaths, 600 Viet Cong deaths, 400 South Vietnamese, 3 Americans. You know, it can't be. It can't be. So, I grew up with that, saying it can't be. Show me. And I think that's a wiser way to be than, yeah, okay. That's, Charlotte said it. It's got to be true. She's an SVP. Yeah, I'm not buying it. Nothing against Charlotte.
No, of course not. Of course not. But the Vietnam War is a catastrophic example of believing the wrong metrics. And you may have heard of, you know, there was the McNamara fallacy, using body count as a metric for success. And
for winning hearts and minds. Yeah, we're going to kill our way to peace.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it's not the way it works. So, I mean, yes. And when actually my last big assignment at Ogilvy was on for a defense contractor in horrible crisis, Boeing. And you realize that anything they said to you was as if Robert McNamara was your client. And that 99% of your job was saying, no, we need to get to something truer than that. What are you really doing about this problem? Not that you're forming a blue ribbon committee. What are you doing? I want to see, literally, I want to see how you've redesigned every bit of code and every screw. And then I will start to believe you. Because you've killed people. And, I mean, thank God they fired me before I had to do the work. But you get the point.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I mean, I shouldn't go off on another tangent here. I'm mindful of how much time I'm taking from you, George. But
oh, no, I'm enjoying this.
I actually went through the Ad Age archives earlier, and I thought I'm going to go right back. So I've read the first few blogs that you wrote. We're going back to June 2007. And I think,
yeah, that's one time ago.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Article 2, though, could have been written today. And you talk about Vonage and their churn rate and the amount they invest in online advertising. And you make a great point at the end and conclude. And it's the parallels are our kind of weird, obsessive focus on short-term over long-term success. And you talk about how, you know, as an agency, your revenue would decrease if they did what you suggested. But right. Your guess is, in the long term, you'd make even more money.
Yeah, well, I remember that insider, if you want to call it an insight, came from a client I worked on in the early 90s. So it was a bank account. And my bosses, we were working on a big local bank in New York. They still had local banks before everything consolidated in America. So they're a big bank, the largest retail bank in New York, and they found out that every week, they gained 250,000 clients, something like that, or maybe 25,000 clients, you know, customers. And, you know, they ran an ad about, you know, there's a reason we gained 25,000 clients every week. Something like that's a good ad. And I talked to my boss about it. He's a fantastic writer. He said, well, every bank gains that many customers a week because they lose that many customers a week. That's the churn of the business. And, you know, they just turned it into an advantage. But I remembered that, like, oh, okay, well, this is an interesting thing. Vonage has to keep getting new customers because they do nothing to retain customers. A little bit like an ad agency, to tell you the truth. You know, because I'd way rather have growth from current clients than getting new clients. If I were an ad agency.
Yeah, agreed. Totally. Number three, then. So aside from The Saddest Words, are there any books you can recommend to our listeners?
Yeah. I read one of the most important books I think I've ever read. I tend not to read literature these days. I tend to read nonfiction. And it's by a woman called Isabel Wilkerson. I believe she won a National Book Award for a book called The Warmth of Other Suns, about the great Black migration around World War One in America. What happened was basically before World War One, basically all the African Americans in the United States lived in the South. That's where they were beholden. And when jobs in the North and cities opened up, factory jobs opened up during World War One, because most of the white men were overseas, this migration up North happened. So that's when cities like Cleveland, New York, you know, Chicago, Detroit, Kansas City, even LA, had huge influxes of African American population. So she wrote a book on that called The Warmth of Other Suns. She's just come out with a new book that got maybe the single best book review I've ever read in the New York Times. The book is called Caste with an E, and it's about the inherent racism, I'm going to say, in our shared political systems, because We were hand in glove between the slave trade and colonialism and all that, but it's the ingrained castiness of the American system. And it's pretty eye opening, because if you look at our political world in America, especially right now, through the lens of, well, some people just need to be kept down, or why does America not have universal health care? Because we don't want to pay for Black people having it. It's a shocking book. It's, you know, if I were king, I would make it required reading. If I were working on Biden's campaign, I would force him to sit down and read it, Kamala too, because it's that important. And I have probably recommended it more than I've recommended any book, except for, you know, Playboy's Party Jokes. it's really pretty amazing. It's not about advertising.
No, well, that's good.
Yeah, but it's about truth.
Perfect. Okay, amazing. That sounds great. We will link to that and The Saddest Words in this listing.
I'll send you the review from the Times, and then there's another review on the Times that has a 45-minute podcast from the author.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so I'll send you those.
Yeah, please do. We'll link out to those. And then number four, we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest, who has to give the reason why. So would you kindly do the honours?
You know what? I'm going to dedicate it to Rob Schwartz. You know, Rob is just, he's a big enough deal in the industry that he'd be permitted to be an asshole. And he's not. He's just a genuinely good person. And he's funny. We've only had drinks twice, I think, or three times maybe in all the time that I know him. But we do a New York, you know, kibitz by email probably at least once a week, where we'll either do Twitter jokes with each other, or we'll just send emails to each other. We reach out to each other with fairly personal things that we're dealing with sometimes, or things we're dealing with in the business or the agency or whatever. And, you know, the first 6 months I thought Rob was trying to recruit me, and then, you know, and then I realized he's nicer than that. Or he's given up on me, or, you know, but he's just a genuinely nice, I think he's the one who connected us, and he's the one who said, you should go on, take my, agency CEO, holding company CEO, thing on the road. You know, it's unusual. And then the last bit of my pay on to Rob is that we need more Robs in the industry, and I'll tell you why in seven words. Creative who's become a CEO. And you know what? If I was running a baseball team, I'd want a player to be manager. If I was running an automobile factory, I'd want a car enthusiast to be running a show. If I was running a restaurant, I'd want it run by a fat guy. And if I was running an agency, I'd like to be run by somebody who loves what agencies do.
Yeah.
Agencies make. And, you know, there's something, I think if we had a fast forward button on our Macs, if Elon Musk made a fast forward button and we could go forward 200 years, you know, and our 7, 9-year-olds were sitting on our laps and saying, Daddy, was there really a time when they put accountants in charge of advertising? You know,
I was about to make that point. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's kind of like, are you serious? They put vegetarians in charge of steakhouses? You know, why would they do that? But that's what's happened.
Yeah. But there was a guy, except a guy called Rob.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, when I grew up in the business, the best agencies in New York, and the same thing in the UK, Abbott Mead Vickers, BBH, Trotz Agencies, Collett Dixon Pierce, most of them had a creative person in the name. And back in the day, when I was young, there was something in America called the Red Book. And it was kind of a New York City phone book sized book that listed every agency, the key people at every agency, every address, and oftentimes their principal accounts. This is like pre-internet, obviously. So if you were looking for a job, you could say, oh, so, you know, lamp and binocular agency, these are the three leads. Oh, none of them are creative. I don't want to work there. You know, you'd want to work at a place, Scally, Amirati, Alley, Levine. Those are, you know, hot New York agencies at the time, Shite Day, where creatives were in the lead. Now you don't have that option, of course. But there was a time in the United States, and that's how you would determine. And if there was no creative, I do this still. I'll look at the Who We Are part, because every agency is the same information architecture. If they don't have a creative person in their, you know, their seven key people, I don't even want to talk to you. I don't even want to talk to you because you're running a driving school and nobody has a license.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. Well said. It's a brilliant dedication as well. So this episode is very proudly dedicated to, well, not only fat guys who run restaurants, but to Rob Schwartz. As a final call to action, everyone listening, head over to this episode's listing and it will be full of all the links to everything we've discussed, including the book recommendations to George's own site. How else can people get more George Tannenbaum in their lives?
Well, they can send a check to my home address. I think I'm pretty easy to find. You know, I'm pretty, you know, the starting of my own business has turned me into, and I've written about this in the past, turned me into a little bit of a fiend on social media. You know, I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn and, you know, I probably get 20 friend requests, whatever they call it, connection requests a week. And, you know, I put all my blog stuff on LinkedIn and some occasional nasty stuff. That's the best thing, you know, my site and all that stuff. But my blogs become my voice, except for the, you know, my CEO. That's become my voice. So that's what I do. Teaching, you know, again at Ad House in the fall. Come visit. I'm living up in Connecticut as long as, we're under disease lockdown. Come visit me.
Yeah.
It's horrible here. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, dear. Well, George, it's been an absolute pleasure and a blast, and I've loved it.
Likewise, Kyle. Yeah, let's do it again.
Thank you as ever for listening to our show. We hope you enjoyed the third episode in our Best of Call to Action series. George is a really lovely fella, and it's been a total pleasure to listen once again to him vent eloquent fire on the state of our industry. We've got some cracking guests lined up over the next couple of months, including award-winning costume designer Mr. Gammon, the LinkedIn B2B Institute's Mimi Turner, and the electric Scott the Boom Morrison. See you there.